Welcome to the Stranger Still podcast. I'm Miles.
I'm Kathleen.
And we are rewatching every episode of Stranger Things ahead of the May and July two-part releases of season 4.
Right.
It's been 3 years, so let's rewatch. Let's catch up together. Today's episode, chapter 5, The Flea and the Acrobat.
What a name.
Who's the flea?
We're about to find out.
So yeah, like Jennifer Hayes crying at our funeral, just wait until we tell you about this episode.
Okay, so chapter 5 starts Hopper investigating the Hawkins lab. So we see him break into the lab, sneak in, I should say. And boy, does he discover a lot. I mean, he, you know, sneaks around all the workers there. He finds the child's bed with the drawing on the wall.
Yeah.
And thinks maybe that's an indication that Will is here. So he keeps looking. He ends up finding the rip.
The rip
into
in the wall.
The upside down.
I did want to just go back real quick to how he gets in there. He slips through the biohazard area and he has this moment like, I'm sure it's fine.
Yeah.
It reminded me of like the invincible like 80s action star who can do everything in while he's in jeans. He can fall
screw
from
it.
A 20 Going story in. Building, catch a helicopter, but as long as he's got his jeans on, he's fine. You know.
There's
also a Star Wars reference, or at least I took it as a Star Wars reference, when he shoots
So once he gets past the barriers, he uses the little card to get through the locked doors and he shoots it.
Yeah.
Just as in Star Wars.
That is a Star Wars classic. And I love this.
And where were the Star Wars? Where did the Star Wars start? The 80s.
The 80s. Well, actually 77. But
okay.
The Star Wars shoot the entrance thing is always whatever the plot needs it to do. If you shoot it and you need the door to open, it opens. If you shoot it and you need the door to lock, it locks. And in this case, it locks. But yeah, he gets in there. He sees the rip and
The hell is this?
Yeah, and he gets injected or...
No, he's caught. I think that they use like chloroform or something, looks like. I can't tell if he's injected or not. I guess I should have paid more attention
to
that
part. Well, he's like checking his neck.
He does, but I don't think he sees anything.
Okay.
Yeah, maybe he does. I don't know. We should know these things. Yeah. We just rewatched and we're going over it for you.
Well, he's captured or he's mm-hmm. knocked out.
He's drugged. He wakes up back in his home and remembers everything and is like, okay, stuff is going on. They're trying to cover stuff up. Mm-hmm. Starts searching his house.
Okay.
Tearing everything apart until he finds a bug. Of course, after he's torn every single part of the house apart, he goes into every single room, checks all of the light bulbs in every room, except for the room that he woke up in, which is where he inevitably finds the bug.
Literally tears the couch cushions before the light. I wanted to ask you, why do you think he wakes up and immediately starts looking for a recording bug?
Well, he knows that it's the government trying to hide something. So, I mean, obviously, as a chief sheriff, he has some understanding of how the government works.
Yeah, I just think like the lab is clearly underestimating Hopper.
They think
he's so stupid.
Small town cop. He doesn't know what he's doing.
Yeah, exactly. Put a couple pills, put a couple beer.
Look at that other deputy. He really is an idiot.
Make him think it's all a dream, right? Yeah. I feel like he was looking for the bug to just confirm that it wasn't a dream. That's what I thought when I was watching it. Like,
makes sense. They would have bugged it. Totally makes sense.
He has like 1 second where he's like, oh my God, did I dream all that? And then he's like, no, that's just stupid.
This has got to be real and I'm going to find proof.
Yeah. And he finds the proof and he gets it there. The other thing that happened at the end of the last episode was Lonnie shows up.
Oh, yes. And we're thinking, you know, what was the purpose of him showing up? What is he there for? And we find out he's just as bad of a dirtbag as we always suspected. Turns out he's just there for the money.
Yeah, he's investigated the site and seen there's no fences and no signs, and they could make money off of Will's quarry death. Yeah,
what
I mean,
a dirtbag.
He is there. You know, there is like some care. Like the first scene you see him, you can see like he's saying like, hey, you gotta snap out of it. He's kind of there to remind us, the audience, too, that all this stuff doesn't make sense because all of our characters are facing, you know, that. Nobody's going to believe you, but yeah, all of our characters are discovering it. True. So,
but he's definitely doing it for an agenda. He's trying to get on her good side to show that he's the caring father that's there to save the day.
Yeah.
We got to get justice for Will.
And as soon as he does say the Sadler Company, you know, they really didn't do it, and she realizes what he's onto, he turns into, you know, you're an idiot. He died because absolutely. Of you. Yeah, so.
I love that she kicks him out. They don't beat around the bush in the show, and that's what I love.
Yeah.
I mean, finally, it's so refreshing.
Yeah, we don't have to go through an episode where Winona Ryder or Joyce thinks that Lonnie maybe is good. Like, no, she reacts like you should react. Get the hell out! I'll keep the Christmas lights up for the rest of my life!
Oh, gosh, I love it. I like Joyce. I know you're not a huge fan of her in season one. She definitely grows on you, though.
It's just stressful. She is at a 10.
I will admit it. It is quite stressful.
She's in her corduroy. She has not changed. She is going.
Yeah. Well, going back to Hopper, you know, they show that scene where his fellow deputies show up at the house and they think he's starting to lose it. You know, he's super paranoid. And even his one friend, the sheriff deputy, I don't know what they're called.
I don't know.
We know all the things.
Officer.
I think that he's been spending too much time with Joyce.
Oh, yeah.
But in that moment, they mention that two guys, Dale and Harry, go missing on a hunting trip, don't come home, and they expect possible foul play. And they ask where they found him, out near Curly. And Hopper says, Mirkwood. Because he knows everything is pointing to that area. Mm-hmm. It's close to the lab. That's where all of the disappearances are happening. This is the episode where he really believes all of this is connected.
Yeah. He didn't think it was all a dream. And thank goodness he didn't. That would have been stupid.
Yes.
Well, the boys in 11, they're doing their own thing here. They're theorizing and they're really uncovering for us, the audience, what the heck is all this stuff? Upside down.
Trying to figure out where Will is. And they start to theorize, 11 says upside down. And this is where we officially coin it as the upside down.
Yeah.
You know, that's, we finally have that name specifically labeled to where Will is. And they, you know, talk about the veil of shadows.
Yeah, because they remember that she turned over the board.
Mm-hmm.
And Dustin's like, oh, well, good news. The veil of shadows. You know, I
good
can,
news.
Good news. Good news is that I can explain this to you.
I love how Dustin always has like the right answers. Logical, as logical as you can be at that age. But he's the like sensible one. This is what's happening. I mean, he discovers all the really important things. I really like that.
Yeah. So he opens up to the veil of shadows and really teaches us, the audience, like what we're really dealing with. It's not aliens, it's not mutants, it's not creation in a lab. They've opened something up upside down, an alternate dimension underneath, or a mirror dimension, basically. You know, I'm not a Dungeons and Dragons player, but I am a good podcast researcher. So I wanted to go look, you know, at the veil of shadows. I wanted to go see what it was and what other details and see where it differed and stuff. Turns out it's not a Dungeons and Dragons thing.
And I just assumed that it was. I, too, have not played Dungeons & Dragons, and I just assumed it was a part of the game, and it turns out it's not.
Yeah,
it's been made for the show.
Yeah, the way that it's right next to you, and you don't even see it. You know, that just sounds like something that has always been there, but, it's not part of the game. And as I was trying to figure this out, I was on, like, Reddit, of course, and there's so many,
Where all the answers are found.
The answers are. And there's a bunch of Dungeons & Dragons nerds in there, and they don't really want to say that it's not part of the game. It's sort of like they're like, oh, you know, I think I can recall something like that. Or, from what I remember, you know, something like, they're not really definitively saying, no, this is not in Dungeons & Dragons. And I know how they feel because they're nerds and they want to say like, oh, we've known about this for way longer than all you people who just tune into a Netflix show like I get to with Star Wars.
I would like to clarify to the audience here that I do classify my husband as a nerd.
Yeah. Yeah. Everyone's learning about Ahsoka for the first time. And I'm just like, you plebeians. You plebeians. So anyway, yeah, I thought that was really surprising that it's not actually part of Dungeons & Dragons.
And then we start to get a more scientific reason for where Will is when they go to the funeral and they start questioning Mr. Clark about alternative dimensions. And he starts to explain what it is and how you can get there. That's where we come across the name of the show, The Flea and the Acrobat, mm-hmm. where he uses the analogy of an acrobat on a high wire and a flea that's able to not only walk, across the top, but across the sideways and the upside down. And he explains to them how would you go about being able to get access if you're not the flea? Mm-hmm. And so he says, well, it would need a massive amount of energy to create a doorway, and then explains, what the precautions of that would be, which is, it would be obvious to everybody, it would disrupt gravity, magnetic field, and environment, may even swallow us whole.
I love that the kids are asking the science teacher about this in theory.
In theory. But like, of course we're not serious.
They're just so good at figuring this stuff out at a kid level still. Mm-hmm. They're testing their hypotheses, they're getting outside expert opinions.
and they have that background of the interest in science that, causes Mr. Clark to not even question it.
I love Dustin's inability to play the part of a mourning kid. He's eating the vanilla wafers and he's laughing at the funeral.
When Lucas is like, we are in mourning.
He's just like,
he's vanilla wafers.
Or pointing out that Jennifer Hayes is crying, wait till we tell Will about this. So they decide that they're going to go back and digest the information from Mr. Clark.
Mm-hmm. And figure out how to get there. And they surmise that 11 is the one that will allow them mm-hmm. to access the upside down.
Yeah.
And that's when Dustin discovers the compasses, which take everybody else and to him a very annoying amount of time to realize what he's trying to tell them, that the compasses, none of them are pointing towards true north. They're pointing towards something else. So that must be the gate that's been opened to the upside down. Mm-hmm. And so they thus follow their investigation to find the gate.
Shouldn't someone else have noticed that?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. The scientists at the lab have certainly.
That's a good point. And presumably other people have.
And Hopper is certainly noticing something fishy, maybe not about the compasses, but and you have to think, is it affecting all compasses all over the United States, or is it only affecting compasses in...
Yeah, I think it's only the town.
Yeah. So, and why else would somebody be looking at a compass in a small town like Hawkins?
I don't know. Maybe that's how the hunters got lost. I don't know.
Good point, babe.
So they go on the train tracks, just like Stand By Me.
Yep, starts to walking down the train tracks. Oh, just like Stand By Me.
This whole thing
reference to an 80s popular movie.
This whole thing story is so Stand By Me. Mm-hmm. Not just the train tracks, but the fight at the end too. It's just so reminiscent of that.
Yep, and then here we see Lucas, always the skeptic of 11. Yep. He does not like her, still very against 11. Starts to suspect that she might not be being truthful. Mm-hmm. Then they arrive at that junkyard, the dumping ground with all the abandoned vehicles and detritus. And
nice word.
Thank you. And he calls 11 out and he says, you've been lying to us. You know where it is. Look at her. She's the one that's been affecting the compasses.
Yeah.
She's running us in circles. And then, of course, him and Mike have that big fight.
Yeah.
And 11, in an attempt to protect Mike, throws with her force mind, throws Mike across the field there. And Lucas.
Lucas, yeah.
And Everybody's upset. Mike's upset that she would do that. Mm-hmm. Lucas is unconscious. They wake him up. He gets mad and he storms off. And they turn around and Eleven has disappeared.
Yeah. And Lucas into the concussion protocol, presumably.
Oh, yeah. that, which they never address.
Yeah. That fight, well, it was the 80s. That fight felt very real for me from both sides. You know, Mike sees the goodness, the real emotion in Eleven. He believes her wholly that that what the people that are after her are bad. And Lucas rightly points out that kind of everything started when she showed up.
Yeah, maybe she's the monster.
Yeah, she is getting something out of this, which is, you know, food and shelter. Like, Lucas points that out pretty well.
Yeah.
So they both have a good side to the argument.
Yeah.
And I feel like that's really, really powerful for us as an audience to have like really two strong arguments mm-hmm. go against each other. And they definitely take it out like kids.
Yeah. But they can't, what they don't see, and you know, it's a big part of that is lack of information.
Yeah.
But they don't see that the reason she doesn't want to guide them is because she's terrified, because she knows what is in the upside down. She knows exactly how dangerous it is. And you see that in her flashback.
Yeah. And she finally does tell them. She says it's not safe or something like that. Way too late, by the way, Eleven.
Well, and that's the only thing she says, too. Yeah. I mean,
but also, like, she doesn't have the social, you know, she wasn't able to communicate that ahead of time. She took it into her own hands to do it this way, mm-hmm. and it makes total sense.
Yeah.
Yeah. So the flashback, you mentioned the flashbacks. We learn a lot that the boys don't learn.
Yep. So she goes, we flash back to the lab, presumably when she first discovers the upside down. Mm-hmm. They're doing yet another test. Dr. Brenner says, I need you to go as farther than you've ever gone before, you know, to try to listen in on somebody in Russia, and sends her to the bath, they call it. And she goes in and she does, in fact, make connection with the guy in Russia. But it's in this blank, black,
astral plane.
Yeah, there's water that they're walking through on the ground. Mm-hmm. She's walking around, and it's in that plane that must hover between their world and the upside down. Mm-hmm. That is when the creature is first introduced.
Yeah, she's on the side of the wire, right? I mean, that's what I've always
walking
taken
in between the two worlds.
She is the flea.
Mm-hmm. she's the flea.
Yeah, so something goes wrong. It's just so good to me. These scientists, they had no idea there could be any possible repercussions. We got to spy on the Russians.
Yep. And then, and it's definitely implied at that point that they force her to do more. I mean, we do learn that later as we watch the series further on, but that they're going to be doing more tests because they want more answers. Yeah.
Now you feel like they're genuinely discovering the upside down in that moment, though, right? They don't know about it before this creature comes out.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. Me too. I think they, at that point, they don't know what it is.
Yeah.
But they know that it is something, and they want to learn more.
Again, they should tell somebody about this. This is so real to life. This is so Cold War, World Wars, 20th century. You know, if they're, not to get into a whole history thing, but if there's one sentence to sum up the history of the World Wars and the Cold Wars, it's the scientists and the military together causing problems. These things don't mix.
Yeah.
These things don't mix. They're discovering the science while they try to apply it militarily, and things go wrong.
And you see that again and again throughout history too.
And here in this documentary that we're watching now called Stranger Things.
This documentary. Yeah.
Like, we'll talk a lot more about what the upside down is. But I don't know that it has to make like perfect sense.
No.
You know, it's,
I mean, we're still discovering it at this point. Yeah.
And I don't think it's never gonna perfectly connect. The core of the show is the characters and their journey. And the mystical parts, you know, it's not quite the purpose of the show. I feel like a lot of people, especially seasons 2 and 3, get turned off because this doesn't make sense with this and this and this. And it's like, you know what? I love Star Wars. And let me talk about things that don't make sense sometimes together. But the core of it is the people.
Yeah.
That we're following.
I agree.
And speaking of the people, two of the MVPs of the show Hopper and Joyce meet together in a scene. Finally, they had they not talked since Hopper cut open the fake will?
Nope. So he, you know, this is of course after she sent Lonnie out, you know, banished him from the house. Mm-hmm. Hopper comes over. I love this scene.
Yeah.
When he comes over, he pounding on the door, she opens it and he's got a sign that says, "Don't say anything."
Yeah.
And she's like, "What the heck is going on?" He sees all the Christmas lights. He's prepared to look at all the light bulbs. And then it's just that, oh, crap.
Yeah. And he does some of them, but he's like, "This is too much work." Again, we're straddling.
No, I think he does all of them.
No, he says, I can't be sure, but that's probably good. That's what he says. Again, we're straddling this line of, is Hopper really good or really not good?
No, I thought that he did all of the big lights. I thought he was saying that because he didn't look everywhere in the house. He just looked at the light bulbs.
Yeah.
But, yeah. And that's the moment where he tells Joyce, "I believe you. You've been right all along. Yep. I went to the morgue. It wasn't Will."
Yeah. And she knew. Fake. And I love that we have this scene. We keep talking about this, but the characters just telling each other what they have found.
Yes.
And talking to each other is just so refreshing.
Finally.
I mean, I love Lost. I love the show of Lost. But those characters wouldn't have told each other what happened for like two seasons.
That's why it's so painful to watch.
I know. So, yeah, he tells them that, he tells her that, and they get that you were right. There's just something so satisfying about the alignment of Hopper and Joyce here. And you're pumped for the next three episodes. You're like, okay, they're a team now.
Finally, we're on our way to discovering like what the heck is happening for real.
Yeah.
All right. On that note, why should we visit Jonathan and Nancy? What are they doing?
Yep. They're going hunting.
Yep. So they, you know, at the funeral, they decide, okay, we are going to find and kill the Demogorgon. Mm-hmm. Of course, that's not what they call it. But so he goes, he steals his dad's gun. They start practicing.
Yeah. Nancy's swinging the bat. Jonathan's shooting the gun. Neither look particularly adept at these tools.
Which is why later when you do see them, you know, searching the woods, that they've clearly switched to weapons.
I love that. I know. Jonathan's shooting the cans and missing the space.
Every single time.
Simpsons callback. He doesn't hit my cans, my precious antique cans. Yep. Yeah. But as they're doing that, they have that fight where, you know, Jonathan, you know, is saying like, "Oh, you're just a suburban girl who thinks she's rebelling but isn't." And then she's saying, "Oh, you're just a pretentious creep," you know.
Yeah, yeah.
So they have that fight. They go into the woods and they stay till dark. They find a deer.
Oh, yes. The poor deer.
Poor deer.
I feel so bad for the deer. She thinks it's been hit by a car, and maybe it has. And they decide, okay, well, we have to put it out of its misery. But before they can kill it, it's drug away suddenly.
Yep.
And so they go searching for where this deer might have been taken and end up separating, and Nancy finds an entrance to the Upside Down.
Yeah, and she goes in.
And she goes,
"Nancy,
why are you doing?
Why are you going in there?" Without even like getting verbal confirmation from Jonathan that they've connected.
Yeah.
Did that make sense to you, why she goes in? I mean, that is
no,
like,
this is the first sign. This is the first moment that I'm like, okay, there's the thing that they do, the stupid thing that somebody does that they shouldn't do that you always see in the movies.
Yeah, I thought maybe like, I was trying to figure out like, why does she do this? She even does it without like telling Jonathan.
Yeah, she calls out his name once. By the way, she calls his name once. He doesn't hear at all. Mm. But while she's in there and she screams, "Oh my gosh, I can hear her screaming. I better go find her.
Jonathan." But like, I thought maybe we're supposed to, in that moment, realize that there is something different about Nancy. Because she's like, I feel like we're being taught in that episode to unravel what we think about Nancy as this good girl who's rebelling, you know, and that's all she is, because that's what Jonathan thinks of her.
That's what Jonathan thinks of her, and but that's not what she is.
Well, I'll tell you, if a teenage, what's her mom's name? Karen? If a teenage Karen comes upon a tree that's dripping goo, she's bolting it. And so, but Nancy doesn't. She goes in. So she is something different. That's what I think. I don't know. And plus, I mean, in her defense, she just thinks it's a tree. She doesn't know.
I don't know.
Does she know she's going into a whole nother world?
Well, I don't.
I mean, she does climb in there with abandon.
I don't know that she knows she's going into another world, but I think that she thinks that this might be the key to where Barb. Maybe.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Barb she's definitely thinking of Barb as her motivation for this.
Yeah.
And that's where the episode ends, right? She's in the upside down and the tree closes up. Oh, the goo closes up.
Yep. So she's in the upside down. She sees the creature feeding on the deer. It hears her break a branch. Yeah. It screams at her. She screams, presumably runs away. Mm-hmm. And then it flashes to Jonathan searching for her as we watch the door to the upside down closing.
Nancy.
And that's how it ends.
Nancy.
Yep.
All right. Good episode. We've set up the final three really well. All the characters, the three different groups, Nancy and Jonathan, Hopper and Joyce, the kids and 11 are all on the trail of what the heck's going on here. So let's wrap up the episode here. Kathleen's feeler moment of the episode, Miles's music moment of the episode. What do you got as a feeler?
All right. So my feeler moment. First, I'd like to say I am an animal lover. Mm-hmm. I love dogs. Yeah. And so they always hold a soft spot. If anything sad happens about a dog, it always gets me just as heart-wrenching. And so that moment where you see Will's dog run into his little hideout area and lay down on the cushion just waiting for Will to return, it's almost like he misses him so much, but he also maybe senses that Will is nearby but not quite there. Oh, that was just heart-wrenching for me. It just, I just have such a hard time with sad pet moments. I mean, we watched, what was it? Chernobyl.
Yeah.
I won't give anything away, but I will tell you there's a scene with the dogs that I was inconsolable. I was ugly crying. Miles trying to explain to me that this isn't real. This is just TV. Yeah. That nothing really happened. But I just couldn't get over it.
Bawling. Yeah.
I was. Yeah. Oh,
poor Chester. Chester's the dog's name.
Oh, I didn't even know his name. Chester.
Music moment of the episode is the band Teenage or Tangerine Dream. Not Teenage Dream. Tangerine Dream. They're a German electronic band that the Stranger Things guys have made clear is their primary influence. And you can very much hear that they inspired this music. And they're an old band, Tangerine Dream. They've released 100 albums from 1970 to last year. You know, so they've been going this whole time. In this episode, Stranger Things just straight uses a Tangerine Dream song.
Oh, okay.
They it's the scene
I'd
where
like to say that I had never even heard of Tangerine Dream until you mentioned that that's who plays a lot of the music in Stranger Things.
I don't think most people would know them, you know, prior to Stranger Things. Stranger Things has made them more famous than they were, even though they had been around for 45 years before Stranger Things.
So they are really benefiting off of this show.
Yeah, and they actually covered the Stranger Things theme. But anyway, they use it in the Hopper searching for the bug scene. That's when we get Tangerine Dream going. It's the song Green Desert. We've got these synthesizers going, interplaying. But there's a prominent drum kit. That song is like synths all over the place with this someone on a full drum kit going nuts. And it's perfect with what Hopper is doing. Hopper's searching through the dishes, the pots and pans. You know, he's
creating a ruckus.
He's almost playing drums as well. In the kitchen. So they use that song straight up. Tribute to the tribute, right? To their main influence, which is the band Tangerine Dream, in that scene, and there's a few others that they use that song as well. So
that was really cool. I just like their touches throughout the show. I mean, as we're watching that end scene, it ends with a song from the '80s called "Nocturnal Me" by by Echo and the Bunny Man, which I've never heard of. I've never heard this song. I've never heard of that, but it did sound 80s like. And yep, it was, it came out on in 1980, I believe. Mm. I just like, I love that, those little touches, everything. Everything references back to the 80s. It's just very authentic. I like that a lot.
Yeah, me too. Though they have used a lot of songs that didn't technically come out in 1983.
But in are world. Heavily influenced by the 80s.
Yeah, but you know, someone should be fired for those blunders.
Okay.
I'm kidding. I'm kidding.
All right. So final question for you, Miles. So now that we have more backstory on Jonathan, do you like him more after getting more insight into why he took Nancy's photos, what he saw in those photos?
No, I don't. Jonathan's explanation is pure BS to me. Did you buy it?
Well, they are purposefully doing this to redeem Jonathan. They want him. I mean, as you watch the episode further, I mean, they clearly don't want you to only see him as this creep.
Yeah.
He is this clearly socially awkward, quiet person who's also very artistic in an analytical way. I mean, we see that with his photography, and he... Yes, it is creepy, but he admits that he shouldn't have been taking her photo, and he apologizes to her for that in last episode. And then he, you know, she asks in this episode, what did you see? What did you see when you took my photo? And he explains.
Yeah. And he says, like, I saw a girl not being herself or whatever. I feel like that's not what Nancy is. Nancy isn't the typical good girl gone bad, you know, gonna go good again. I feel like that's what we're supposed to take away from that. I think Jonathan has growth from that explanation to see her as more than that. And that's how they...
I definitely agree with that. But I also think that she is at this moment where she... her life could lead one way or the other. She could repeat what's happening with her parents, you know, a loveless marriage. They are just doing what is expected of them socially. And he, that's what he sees, because
it's a big Nancy episode, big Nancy and Jonathan episode. Mm-hmm. And plus it's hard because rewatching in retrospect with our love for Steve makes this harder.
Yeah. Oh, gosh. Yeah. Because she's with Steve. We really like Steve.
She's with Steve. So it's like, you know, I don't know. Okay.
I would just like to point out how much Jonathan looks like a young Neil Young.
Oh, I know. God, he's got the hair.
In a good way. I mean, I think Neil Young looks creepy, okay? And he looks just like Neil Young.
It's like Buffalo Springfield Neil Young. I feel like he's going to pull out a guitar at any time and roll to go to Sugar Mountain, you know?
But I do think that he's meant to look kind of loner, creepy. Oh, but we're also supposed to... you know, be able to sympathize with him, which is what the Duffer brothers are trying to do with the scene where he's explaining why he took the photos and why
He is, they've got a story to tell. So, all right, that is episode 5. We'll be back, and we're really ramping up to the end of season 1. Super good. Super excited to do that. My name is Miles.
I'm Kathleen.
And good night.